We're glad that you have come our way. If you're visiting with us, we want to encourage you to come back at every opportunity you have to be with us here at Eastside. Got a little ahead of myself. By the way, we're talking about the Bible this morning. No, we're going to be a little bit more in depth than that. The Bible is a challenging book to a lot of people. And there are particular passages that are more challenging than others. And one of those passages sometimes can be the Gospel of Matthew. I'm like Larry, I'm forgetting things. I might have to make sure I'm turned on.
I don't know how you can see up there with that light.
That's not the one, that's the one. But in the Gospel of Matthew, and the reason we're going to have this lesson today and next Sunday, Lord willing, is because we're coming quickly upon Matthew chapter 24. And that's what we want to discuss. It's Matthew chapter 24. It is a challenging passage as Jesus has this discussion here on the Mount of Olives. And it's given shortly after he left the temple and was talking to his disciples in Matthew chapter 23 and given the seven woes or warnings. It's recorded for us in Matthew chapter 24 and Mark 13 and Luke 21. But when people begin to talk about the destruction of Jerusalem and everything, they always focus on Matthew 24. They don't think about Mark 13 and Luke 21. This is oftentimes referred to as the Olivet Discourse. And our focus is primarily going to be on Matthew's account, chapter 24, verses 1 through 51, because that's where we'll be, hopefully, in two Sundays. Depends on how much discussion we have on the rest of the woes in chapter 23. Which, by the way, that's not a bad thing. I like the discussion. But it is a difficult passage, as there are different interpretations that need to be considered on Matthew's account. Some people maintain that it is the second coming of the Lord, because of the events preceding up to his second coming, and that it is only about his second coming. Others say that it's entirely about the destruction of Jerusalem that takes place in AD 70. And yet many believe that it contains both things being discussed in this chapter. There's a lot to be discussed in this chapter, so we're not going to take it all in one sermon. You're probably going to, by the time we get done with this, you're probably going to be thinking, that's a long sermon anyway, because there is so much to cover. But even those who say that it refers to both events still have differing opinions or ideas as to when the particular event that he's describing in Matthew's account actually take place. Some say that verses 4 through 28 refer to the destruction of Jerusalem. And in verse 29, then he begins his discussion about his second coming. And that's what J.W. McGarvey talks about in his fourfold gospel. That's the way he looks at it. Others contend with the idea that verse 35 begins Jesus is talking about his second coming. And then there are still others that say Jesus switches back and forth throughout this whole discourse. Some people have trouble with the events of Luke 17 describing them coinciding with Matthew 24 here, because both events are described here. In Luke 17, Jesus is talking about one day, one of the days of the Son of Man. And he alludes here to the fact that there is more than one day of the Son of Man. The Lord, he says, will come in judgment in ways prior to his final coming at the last day. In the discourse, according to Matthew, or in Luke 17, Jesus uses very similar language to what is used in Matthew's account, but in ways that don't necessarily allow for a simple division in Matthew chapter 24, either at verse 29 or at verse 35. In Luke 17, verses 26 through 39, 29 is a parallel to Matthew chapter 24, verses 37 through 39. And then Luke 17, verses 34 and 36 is a parallel to Matthew 24, verses 43, 41. But if Jesus is describing just one event in Luke 17, and I believe he is, then he is likely describing just one event in Matthew chapter 24. At this time, in his Mount of Olives discussion, the Olivet Discourse in Matthew chapter 24, he is depicting the destruction of Jerusalem, which occurred later on in AD 70. History records that for us, that it actually took place. And it certainly foreshadows his second coming, and we're going to see why, with the beginning of the setting of the Olivet discussion. The words of Jesus take place in the temple with his finishing up his parables beginning in Matthew 21. He gives parables teaching about Israel's rejection of him back in chapter 21, verses 28 through 32. He talks about the parable of the two sons. And in Matthew 21, verses 33 through 46, he continues there with the parable of the wicked vine dresser. And then in verses 24, or chapter 22, verses 1 through 14, you remember he talked about the parable of the wedding feast. And then he gives a condemnation of the Pharisees and the scribes. We see that in Matthew chapter 23. And this would fill up a great deal of their father's guilt, measure of their father's guilt, we see in verses 29 through 32. And he talks about in this passage in verses 33 and 34 that they are the ones who kill, crucify, scourge, and will prosecute or persecute the prophets, the wise men and the scribes, who God would send to them. You know from biblical history that that's the way they treated God's messengers. And Jesus alluded to that even in some of his parables where he talked about the kingdom. And he says upon them, in verses 25 through 36 of this chapter 23, he said, upon whom the blood of all the righteous would come, upon that generation that was standing there listening to him. That's the generation he's referring to in Matthew 23. And then we close out Matthew 23 with his lamentation over Jerusalem. In verse 37, in the first part there, he talks about that this is the city who kills the prophets and stones those who were sent to her. The second half of verse 37, he says, the city is unwilling to accept the love that has been shown to her. And then in verses 38 and 39, he says that this house, whose house, Jerusalem that is, would be left desolate. Destroyed. So Jesus here is talking about a prophecy. He's given a prophecy about the temple. Verse 20, chapter 24 and verse 1, you'll remember we discussed this morning that in the last verse of chapter 22, he dumbfounded or shut up the mouths of the Pharisees and the scribes, and they couldn't answer him, so they turned. Verse 1 of chapter 24, he begins to talk to his disciples and the multitude that's there, and showing them the buildings of the temple. And he's going to allude to some of this in the warnings or the woes that he gives to the Pharisees and scribes about taking oaths later on in chapter 24. Declaring that not one stone of this temple that he's showing them would be left upon another. Verse 2 of chapter 24. But then the disciples have questions. And rightly so. Just like we have questions today. They wanted to know, according to Mark's gospel and Luke's gospel and Matthew's gospel, two questions were asked in all three accounts. In Mark 13 and verse 4, tell us when will these things be? And the second question is, and what will be the sign when all these things will be fulfilled? In Luke, it's very similar. He says in chapter 21 and verse 7, so they asked him, saying, teacher, but when will these things be? And what will there be, and what sign will there be, I'll get it out in a moment, when these things are about to take place? People have always looked for signs. Even you today, if you put out a garden, how many of you look to the farmer's almanac? Or maybe you remember what your granny and papa used to tell you about when to put gardens out or flowers out or treat babies for certain things. It's always when the moon is in a certain phase. We look for signs, don't we? How many of you look to the sky at night and you see a red sunset? And you may not remember it, but there used to be an old saying, red skies at night, sailors delight. Red skies in the morning, the sailors be warm. We look for signs even today. In Matthew's account, in verse 3, tell us, the disciples said, when will these things be? And what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? So technically, I guess they asked three questions. But there's some observations we need to make at this point. When Matthew wrote his gospel, he's writing to strictly a Jewish audience. And he likely recorded the questions as the disciples were asking, who presumed the destruction of the temple would mean his coming and the end of the age. That when this house of God would be destroyed, that would be the end of all things and everything would come to fruition. Both the nation of Israel and the house of God be destroyed, as well as the end of time. And Jewish readers who Matthew is writing to would likely have the same conception. Remember, in Matthew's account, as we studied this morning, he's no longer speaking to the Pharisees and scribes, but he turns his attention to the disciples and the multitudes that are there, the Jewish people. So they're going to want to know. Mark and Luke wrote to Gentiles. So to avoid a possible misunderstanding by non-Jewish readers, they worded the disciples' questions to reflect what the discourse is actually about. In other words, the destruction of the temple and the sign of its destruction would be imminent. So when the setting leading up to this Olivet discourse is carefully considered, the subject of Jesus' words, I think, become clear. The destruction of the temple is the matter under consideration, not the second coming of Christ. So we're going to begin our discussion of that and see if we can't muddy up the water for some of us a little bit better, or make it clearer. This Olivet discourse, or discussion, the first question, or one of the questions was, what will be the sign? Well, let's talk about what will not be the sign. He tells us in verses 4 through 5 of chapter 24, to be careful that you are not deceived. Don't be deceived. Now, there are people in this world today that would have different views about the end of time and the 80-70 doctrine and all this. And they believe that Christ has already returned under this AD-70 doctrine. My question is, why do you still assemble with the saints if you believe Christ has already returned? And I had a question posed to me the other day in a discussion about it. Do you still observe the Lord's Supper if you believe in the AD-70 doctrine that says Jesus has already returned? What does it say on the front of that table? This do in remembrance of me. And he gave clear instructions to observe it until I return. So if he has returned, why are we still doing this? Be careful that you are not deceived. There are going to be some that claim to be Christ. And that's what he talks about in verses 4 and 5. He says also, don't be troubled with wars, earthquakes, famines, pestilence. Well, isn't that what's going on in the world right now? And has been for several years. He says in Matthew 24, verses 6 through 8, and you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not troubled. For all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. For nation will rise up against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines, pestilences, and earthquakes in various places. All these things are the beginning of sorrows. Notice he says, see that you're not troubled. Don't let these things worry you. Be anxious for nothing, as he talked about in Matthew chapter 6. He says, but all these things are the beginning of sorrows. But it's not the sign of the end. These things that you're going to hear, these wars and earthquakes and things of this nature, they are a sign of the end, but it's the end of the temple. And he says, many will be offended because you're going to fall upon hard times. You're going to hate one another. And you're going to betray one another. Brothers and sisters in Christ will turn against one another, he says, at this time. False prophets are going to deceive. The love of many will grow cold because of lawlessness. But he who endures to the end, he says, will be saved. And the end here refers to those, not to the second coming, implying one must live until Christ comes again, nor of the destruction of Jerusalem. But it's implying once one has survived that event, then one's salvation is secured. But to the end of one's life. Many will be offended, he says. Let me catch up to my slide here. The end here, I thought I was off on my slides, and that's why I'm behind. But we like to look at Revelation 2 and verse 10. And he says, do not fear any of those things which you are about to suffer. Indeed, the devil is about to throw some of you into prison, that you may be tested, and you will have tribulation 10 days. This is what we like to look at in Revelation 2 and verse 10. Be faithful until death, and I will give you the crown of righteousness. The gospel of the kingdom, he says, is going to be preached to the world, according to verse 14 in Matthew 24. And he said, it's going to be a witness to all nations. Then the end, he says, the destruction of the temple will come. This is going to refer to the end of Jewish sacrifices and the other remnants of the Old Testament worship. That which was nailed to the cross, abolished by Jesus' death, is going to pass away, he talks about. Colossians 2, Ephesians 2, Hebrews chapter 8. Now the question begs to be asked, was the gospel preached to all nations before AD 70? There are people that will argue with you and say that the gospel has not been preached at this point. What about that little island off in the Pacific somewhere that nobody's ever gotten to? I don't think that's what he refers to. I think he's referring to all known nations at that time. Gospel would still be spread to all nations eventually throughout history, to all these little islands. But I think what Jesus is referring to, and Paul in later accounts, is referring to the known world at that time. You have to realize that even the known world at that time goes down into Africa, to Egypt, Alexandria, Moab, other places like that, Sinai, what would be known as Saudi Arabia today, Turkey, and on up into Rome, up into what would be known as Germany today. There were Christians that were being spread up into those areas. So yes, Paul was referring to the known world at that time. Romans chapter 10, verses 16 through 18, but they have not all obeyed the gospel. For Isaiah says, Lord, who has believed our report? So then faith comes by hearing, and hearing by the word of God. But I say, have they not heard? Yes, indeed. Their sound has gone out to all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. So I believe that to the end of the world is what they know as the world at that time. You have to remember the world was still being discovered. You remember Christopher Columbus from your history books? And they didn't want him to sail off into the Atlantic because when he went over the horizon, they thought he fell off the edge of the world. The known world had the gospel preached to it. Paul writes in Colossians 1 and verse 23, if indeed you continue in the faith, grounded and steadfast, and are not moved away from the hope of the gospel which you heard, which was preached to every creature under heaven, of which I, Paul, became a minister. So Paul says, I preached everywhere that I've gone to the known world at this time. So the sign is not going to be the rumors of wars and things of this nature. So what will be the sign? He says in verse 15 of Matthew 24 and Mark 13 and verse 14, he mentions the abomination of desolation. He talks about standing in the holy place, the city of Jerusalem, the holy city. Daniel chapter 9, verses 26 and 27 talks about this, the abomination of desolation. Jesus says, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, that's going to happen in the very lifetime of some of these people. When you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, Luke therefore explains this as the abomination desolation. In AD 70, this took place. Roman armies surrounded and besieged Jerusalem before it came into the city and destroyed it and the temple. And so Jesus answers the disciples' question, what sign will there be when these things are about to take place? When you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies. Now, what were they to do when they see this sign? In Matthew 24, verses 16 through 22, Jesus says, flee. Those in Judea are to flee to the mountains. Don't delay. When I read this, it's kind of like the Passover and about to leave Egypt. Don't go back and get your clothing. Don't go back and pack anything. You leave as soon as you see these armies beginning to surround Jerusalem. Don't delay. Don't go to your home. Don't pack up anything. And he says it's going to be a difficult time for a woman that's pregnant or a woman that's nursing children. But he says, pray. Pray that your flight not be in winter, when the travel would be even more difficult. Or on the Sabbath, when the city gates are closed to travel. You realize if Titus had come in AD 70 and waited until the Sabbath to where they closed the gates, how bad the destruction of Jews would have been. But he didn't. And it allowed the Christians in that time to flee because they listened to Jesus. And he says there will be great tribulation, though shortened for the sake of the elect. Luke specifies the nature here in verses 23 through 24. He says there will be great distress in the land and wrath upon this people, and they will fall by the edge of the sword and be led away captive into all nations. And Jerusalem will be trampled by Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. There was a Jewish general that was taken captive when Titus and the Romans captured Jerusalem. Just prior to the city's destruction in AD 70, he wrote down a few notes that have been passed down. He says, all the calamities which have befallen any nation from the beginning of the world were but small in comparison to the Jews. This is bad. That's what he's saying. What's taking place in Jerusalem now is bad. Everything else that's happened in the world does not compare to this. He might have had some personal feelings involved in that too. But he says, in the siege of Jerusalem, no fewer than 1.1 million Jews perished. We oftentimes just talk about the destruction of the temple and the city. But the Romans took the lives of 1.1 million people. You see why they wanted to know what the sign of the end was and when will these things be? And he says it was the time of the Passover, when there would have been more than 3 million Jews assembled in Jerusalem. But it wasn't just Jerusalem that was affected. In the provinces surrounding Jerusalem, he says there were also 250,000 that were killed. 250,000 people, more than a million, that were killed by the Roman army under Titus. He said there were 97,000 Jews that were taken captive and then later killed by the Romans in Rome by the beast in theaters. Some were sent to work in Egypt. Others sold as slaves. This comes from a recording of Flavius Josephus. is Jewish wars, as is quoted in Barnes' commentary on Matthew. The elect that are referred to are Christians. Do you realize they were spared from all this calamity? 1.1 million Jews, 250,000 slain, 97,000 Jews taken captive. Not one of them was a Christian. You ever wondered about that? Because they listened to Jesus. When the destruction of Jerusalem took place, the Christians listened to Jesus. The Jews, the Christians, were spared this shortened siege. They were in the city, the Jews were in the city and were engaged in battle with the Romans. Titus, the Roman general, being called to return to Rome, cut his siege short and proceeded to end the siege and storm the city, according to Barnes' commentary. Jesus said in Matthew 24, verses 33 through 38, "Do not be misled by false Christ and false prophets. Even those that show great signs and wonders to deceive." He says, "For the coming judgment of the Son of Man will be like the lightning across the sky. Don't expect to find him in the desert or in the inner room." He says, because when he comes in the judgment, it's going to be swift. Luke's account, chapter 17, verses 22 through 24. He says, "Where the carcass is, there the eagles will be gathered," alluding to Jerusalem being surrounded by her enemies. "This is the sign that they were given to warn them that it was time to flee Jerusalem and Judea." This is part one. So far, all this depicts a local, inescapable, or a local escapable judgment from the city of Jerusalem. Jesus loved this city. He loved the people of this city. And he warned them and those in Judea of what was about to come in the very near future. And they were given a sign to let them know when to flee. And really, many believe that up to verse 29 or verse 35, Jesus is foretelling the destruction of Jerusalem and its temple. And it occurred in AD 70. But it doesn't fit with a worldwide ending, inescapable judgment. And we'll characterize that in the second coming of Jesus. As Paul and Peter taught Christians throughout the Mediterranean world about the coming of Christ and this destruction at the end of time. Peter writes in 2 Peter 3, verses 10 through 12, "But the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night. You look for a sign, but you're not going to know when he's coming," he says. "In which the heavens will pass away with a great noise, and the elements will melt with fervent heat. Both the earth and the works that are in it will be burned up." You can't get away from it. So why would Jesus say flee? Because he's talking about two different things. We're not going to be able to escape this judgment, the second coming of Christ. Lord willing, in our next study, as we continue this, we're going to pick up with verse 29. And it certainly sounds like the second coming of Christ. But is it? Or was Jesus still describing events that pertain to the destruction of Jerusalem? I want to finish with a little bit of history for you. Eusebius, in 300 AD, wrote in a book called Ecclesiastical History that Christians heeded the warnings of Jesus in Matthew 24. And they fled from Jerusalem to the mountains and to the hills when the army of Rome surrounded it. And he said there was not a single one to die. Fascinating. Fascinating that people actually listened to the Son of God when he gave them instructions. But I guess it's different because they want to be warned about physical dangers. But when he warns about spiritual dangers, we can take it or leave it. It's a sad, sad state of affairs with people that believe in God. I pray that we also will heed the words of Jesus and not be misled by false prophets and false Christ, not be troubled by wars or rumors of wars and famines and pestilence, earthquakes, or even persecution, but that we will endure until the end by remaining faithful to Him and look forward to His final coming. Like I said, it is interesting that no Christians lost their lives in the siege of Jerusalem in AD 70, even though there were well over a million Jews that died. Not one of them was a Christian because they listened to Jesus. Are you listening to Jesus? He's giving you warnings day after day after day in our lives of what to look for, how to live our lives, to be faithful when He returns. We don't know when He's coming back. He said it's going to be like lightning stretching across the sky. You know, by the time you watch lightning start, and by the time it gets over here, it's already finished over here, so you can't catch the lightning. It's that fast. But when He comes back, are we going to be ready? You see, right now is the day of salvation. Right now is when we need to be preparing. If you have something in your past that you have yet to repent of, now is the time to do it. I don't care how far back in your past you need to go to repent. But you need to be right. It may be that you've never put Christ on in baptism, and you need to be thinking about that because He's coming back as a thief. You know, the whole argument with preachers is, if you knew a thief was going to break into your house, you'd make preparation for him, wouldn't you? You'd be sitting in the house with a shotgun waiting on him to come in the door and say, "I got you." Or you'd at least make sure all the doors were locked and the alarm was set before you left. But you don't know when He's coming back. You don't know that you'll make it home this afternoon. You don't know that you'll make it back here this evening. As certain as life is, it is just as uncertain. Just like watching the lightning across the sky. You see it begin, you see it end, and then it's gone. Like James says about the vapor, it's here and then it's gone. That's our life. We have no guarantees of the next hour, the next day, the next week, the next month. We make plans, but there's no guarantee that we'll be able to keep those plans. Christ is going to return. The big question is, are you ready? I think the invitation song is titled, "Bring Christ Your Broken Life." If your life is broken, if you're marred down in sin, why not do something about it? Why not do something about it right now? Make your way to the front if we